Hi, thank you for tuning in to the Finding Harmony podcast with me, your host, Harmony Slater. Hello and welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. We have a very special episode for you today. Actually, it will just be myself meeting with Philippa Asher, another certified Ashtanga yoga teacher. She is actually the only British woman to be certified by Sri K. Pattabhi Joyce, and she is right now in London, or just outside of London, teaching yoga. And so we are connecting on all kinds of interesting topics like ballet and the similarities between dance and Ashtanga yoga, and also the differences between ballet and Ashtanga yoga. Philippa began learning and practicing Ashtanga yoga in the late 1990s, as I did. We have a lot in common. But then she began working in the media and film and music industries for several years. She had a really nice job where she could go back and forth between England and Mysore so that she could continue practicing and studying under Pattabhi Joyce and Sharat Joyce. And so she eventually finished all series, the Advanced A and Advanced B, and was certified and started teaching a Mysore program in 2006 in Soho's Ashtanga Tri Yoga program in London. So we are diving into the practice, her thoughts and her beliefs about the practice, as well as how it's helped both her and I overcome different obstacles in our life. And I think you're just going to really enjoy this interview. It's a special one, one for the ladies maybe, as two women who have been practicing for over 20 years connect and talk about how the practice has affected them on many different levels through many different stages of life. So I think you're really going to love this up close and personal interview with Philippa, and I hope that it's one of your favorites. And also, just a reminder to join my inner circle. I hope that you'll come in and you can practice with me online on Fridays. If you're in the UK or Europe, it's on Friday afternoons. So maybe you get a little early leave from work if you're working, or you take Friday afternoon as your special time to yourself. If you are in North America, it is Friday mornings at 5 a.m. on the West Coast and 8 a.m. on the East Coast. We have weekly Mysore classes as well as monthly conferences and philosophy classes where we're studying Yoga Sutra philosophy, as well as you get bonus Finding Harmony podcast episodes. You'll get to hear all of the behind the scenes info that we go through with our guests. It's really fun, as well as some extra conversations that I've had inside of the clubhouse with other authorized teachers, or teachers that you probably know and love, like Greg Nardi and Scott Johnson and Zena. So lots of great UK energy inside the Inner Circle membership. You also get to connect with me through WhatsApp, through a private Facebook group. There's so much good energy happening in my Inner Circle, and I am only opening it up. This will be the last time this year until the end of the year in January. So I hope that you come in and end the second half of 2022 strong. Joining me inside the Inner Circle membership, we'll have a lot of fun, and I look forward to being able to support you in your practices through pranayama, chanting, Mysore weekly, as well as philosophy and conferences where you get to ask all your questions and get some personal guidance and personal coaching. So that's all happening this month. Sign up. It's going to be awesome. It already is awesome. I just want you to join the incredible people that are already inside the Inner Circle membership. There's so many wonderful, wonderful, amazingly supportive people. We have a great community there. Everybody, starts to know each other and we have great conversations. So it's open. Check out my website, harmonyslater.com, and you'll find the link there where you can find out all the information and how to join. So without further ado, here is Philippa Asher. Hi, welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. I'm your host, Harmony, and today I am joined by Philippa Asher. Hi, Philippa, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Hello, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Where in the world are you right now?
I'm in England, in London. Yes.
And it sounds like that's where you grew up.
Yeah. I grew up in England. Yes. Most of my life has been here until I moved to India. Yeah.
Wow. And we'll get to that. But tell me a little bit like what it was like growing up in England. I know we share a love for ballet and dance.
We do. Yes. So so I went to a vocational ballet school in Sussex from aged 12, which was amazing. As you know, the discipline of ballet is an incredible skill that we can use in the practice of yoga. You become incredibly body aware from a very young age. And it was lovely. I loved ballet school. It was tough. Particularly 1980s, where teaching was quite different from how it is today. But yeah, that was amazing. And after ballet school, I went to university in Surrey, where I did my first degree in dance, anthropology, history and performance. And then I did a postgrad in the education of adults. And then I worked for a couple of ballet companies in London, English National Ballet and the Royal Ballet Company, in their education departments, which was great. And then I was in London, and I ended up working in media for music and film in Soho. So, so most of my life has been, in the south part of England.
Beautiful, beautiful. Did you find... the teaching style of, like you said, ballet in the 80s was particularly grueling and maybe like a little bit, I think in the arts culture, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, like, you know, sort of like that old school methodology of like trying to like break you down to make you stronger so you can survive. I don't know.
I mean, if you want your kids to be tough, send them to boarding school. You become very, very self-sufficient from a very young age. And particularly my school being a ballet school, it was very, very tough. You had to be the best. I mean, we were weighed every week.
It's intense.
You weren't allowed to put on any weight. You had to excel at everything. We had test classes every term, in ballet. And if you weren't good enough, you were chucked out. There was constant pressure. So yes, you're absolutely right. It made you incredibly tough. And we were very obsequious. I mean, we never answered back. You did as you were told. You didn't question anything. And it was grueling. You know, you would practice and practice and practice and practice until you were absolutely perfect. doing classes for many, many hours a day. But, you know, if that's what you know, that's what you do, isn't it? That's normal. So that kind of being in a studio scenario, wearing Lycra for hours a day is home for me. That's my happy place. I'm used to it.
It's sort of funny how it translates to yoga. I was thinking about this a lot lately, like even that discipline, like that very disciplined lifestyle where as a dancer, maybe you're not like a professional athlete, but like you're really, you know, from a young age trained to pay attention to your diet, to maybe not your sleep so much, but definitely your sleep. Like you start to notice like, oh, I'm not performing well today because, and you start to have that maybe habit of self-reflection.
looking absolutely. At like, yeah, all the different things that might be affecting why you're not feeling as good as you did the day before?
Do you know what? I think for me, it was, you know, brush yourself down and carry on.
Right, yeah.
You know, yeah. There was no time for being self-absorbed or considering why we might not be feeling well. It was just, you know, the show has to go on. You've got to be amazing. So yeah. I think, you know, back then, yeah, even if you were feeling rubbish or you weren't, you know, 100%, you just carried on because you had
yeah.
to.
Yeah, totally, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you feel like, I mean, you know, going through, we'll get to sort of your yoga journey, but like, you know, you're one of the few female certified Ashtanga yoga teachers. Do you feel like that training or that discipline, that tenacity or grit that you cultivated as like a young girl, as a ballet dancer, like was something that helped to carry you all the way through like advanced A, advanced B, like all these advanced series?
Absolutely. There's no way I could be where I am now if I hadn't had that vocational ballet school training. Mm. And also having my postgrad in the education of adults from mm. university, there's absolutely no way I could do what I do now. I think not only does the ballet training teach you so much about bodies and how they work, you can just look at a body and you know what it needs to do in order mm-hmm. to execute an asana, and you can help people very, very quickly, but also you can just be in the studio for 5 or 6 hours with no break and you have so much stamina. Mm-hmm. And when you are teaching, as you know, teaching this practice, you're adjusting people constantly. You know, so we do our 2 hour practice and then we're teaching for like 5 hours plus with no break, running mm-hmm. around, adjusting people, going from one person to another, managing the room. You know, it's mm-hmm. not only incredibly demanding physically, but you cannot let your attention waver for one moment. So I think the dance training gives you the power, the stamina, and the discipline to be able to do that day after day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to yeah. still love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sort of like getting into that zone where like, you're not really like, you know, maybe it's like a flow state even where you're just like, not even hungry or like, yeah. even like the calls of nature aren't really bothering you. It's almost yeah. like a meditation practice. I think like what you're talking about, that teaching sort of for those long hours, just like moving between people and watching and managing the room and, you know, analyzing bodies, like it's really happening on a different level of consciousness almost.
It just feels very, very natural. And I think, you know, if you've been a dancer and you've been, you know, dancing since you were 3 years old, it's just second nature. It just feels mm-hmm. totally natural and normal. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just very, very natural, very normal. And you know, wearing lycra and being in a studio is just, yeah, where I like to be.
Yeah. And it always struck me as kind of funny, you know, people always think that being a dancer like helps the physical yoga practice. And I mean, maybe a little bit, like you were saying with the body awareness and like understanding how to move your body in very specific ways and ranges of motion and things. But for me, I always felt like it was that discipline and that like strong mind aspect where that was cultivated from such a young age, like coming yes. up to adversity again and again and again, and just like figuring out how to like get through that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, in terms of conquering a complicated new asana, we don't have that fear. You know, it's very easy to make heaps of excuses. Oh, I can't do this because, you know, I've got the wrong colored nail varnish on or whatever. You know, for mm-hmm. if you've had that dance discipline, you will keep trying and trying and trying in a slightly different way until you have made the impossible become possible, because that's the training. You yeah. simply don't give up.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know about you, but certainly for me, I found that obviously the discipline was incredible, but and the flexibility was great, but being a ballet dancer, I didn't have a very strong upper body. So I can remember in my first class, God, it was so hard. So yeah. I think for me, I mean, obviously I've got incredibly strong legs because ballet dancers do, and a strong back because ballet dancers do. But it took me years and years and years and years to build the upper body and the arm strength. So, so attaining the balance was the hard thing. And I think possibly you're at a disadvantage if you go into the asana practice having more of one thing than another. Maybe it's easier if you're equally weak and inflexible, so you can, you know, develop them simultaneously and have balance throughout the practice. I don't know, but I've often wondered that.
Yeah, that's I remember that too. I remember actually the first time that I really like dove into Ashtanga yoga and like trying to do a daily practice. My wrists got so sore. I got such bad tinnitus that I couldn't even, I had to stop. I had to take a rest because it was like to the point where I couldn't pick things up anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Which, well, you know what happened to me. I'm sure we'll get into that later, but.
Yeah, but let's talk about it now. Cause I like what happened to you always made me think about that because it was just like, it was so painful.
So, I learned the primary and the intermediate series very quickly. And it was when I was learning the advanced A series arm balances. One of the tendons snapped. It's the tendon that works the thumb. It snapped in my left hand. And so I basically had to have a tendon graft. And then 2 years later, it went on the other side. So you probably remembered me when I was in Mysore and it happened on the other side. Right. And I had to have a tendon graft locally in Gokulam.
Yes, I was thinking about that.
So I was practicing the next day like an idiot in a flimsy bandage. So when it snapped in London, I think the surgeon sussed me out and he put me in a really heavy, do you remember those old-fashioned plaster casts we used to get back in the day? And they were heavy, plaster of Paris, and you used to kind of like, people used to write on them. It was one of those. And he didn't take it off for 2 months because I think he knew I would just be an idiot and ruin it. but when I had the same operation done in India, I was in a flimsy bandage. So like a fool, I was in class the next day swinging around. Obviously, I couldn't put my palm on the floor because I'd, you know, snap my tendon. But I was swinging around on my fist, and I bust the stitches basically, and I had to go back to the surgeon with my, you know, tail between my legs to show him my bloody plaster, my band.
Oh my gosh.
And he sewed me up with no anesthetic to teach me a lesson.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, to be young and foolish. But you know, I was in my 30s, you know, but it's extraordinary when you're that age, you think you're invincible. And I think that when you've been practicing for 20 plus years, you have a bit more wisdom, don't you? Yeah. And you listen to your body and when you break a tendon, you let it heal. So that was interesting. So basically why that happened was I was doing too much weight bearing on a non-weight bearing joint before I had the muscles to support myself. So the surgeon in London explained it to me. He said that my wrist had grown an extra layer of bone to kind of make it stronger, but that was jagged, and the tendon which glides over the top of it was basically being sawed through until it snapped. So I learned quite a lot from that incident. So then I realized that I had to get incredibly strong, and I realized the importance of resting between those arm balances. And I remember it was kind of trendy in those days to not rest between the arm balances. You had to muscle through. And I just realized now that was just dreadful advice.
Yeah,
you know, ladies aren't built like men. We're totally different. You know, guys have got these broad shoulders and long backs and tiny waists and little hips. But women are, you know, we're different, right?
Yeah, totally. We have to heave our center of gravity up off the floor.
We do because we have ladies' hips and we have narrower shoulders. So in order to execute an arm balance, we need to do it in a different way. So I think, you know, it's certainly quite helpful to have female teachers like you and me around who figured out how to do it without snapping your tendons.
Totally, right? Yeah, those arm balances are so grueling. And I remember especially learning them too, because like you say, you haven't developed the muscle strength yet. So it can be a lot of weight on that wrist joint, which is not like a super strong joint, especially if you're have like petite wrists, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I always would stretch them out the opposite way and give them a break in between.
Well, exactly. Well, you think about it, throughout the practice, we're doing one asana and then we do the counter pose, don't we?
Exactly.
But not for the wrists. Not until you get to Urdhva Padmasana do we get the opportunity to flip the hand the opposite way. But that's right at the end of the practice. So you just said, you've got to factor it in, haven't you? You've got to stretch your wrists out the other way. So they're getting a little release.
It's so important to listen to your body and allow the healing to happen too. And I think when you're young, you know, there's more urgency in a sense, and you also have more energy. So maybe you don't listen enough to what you really need.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And that's another interesting thing about the practice, because when you're young and you have that energy, you know, the asanas are less complicated, but then you get older and older and older as the postures get harder and harder and harder.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So that's a real, laugh, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. It's like a little adding a layer of difficulty to it all.
There's no opportunity for complacency ever.
No, it's true. It's true. So tell me a little bit about how you transitioned from ballet into yoga and this spiritual journey you've been on.
Right. So when I was three, my mother had a book. This was in the 1970s. It was called Yoga for Health by a guy called Richard Hittleman. Mm. And this book, on the front cover, had pictures of ladies with lovely flowing locks in these brightly colored leotards doing these amazing shapes. And inside this book were lots of shapes. And at the end of the book, there's a picture of Padmasana. So I can remember as a tiny child, age three, going to this book every day and copying the shapes in the book and then sitting in Padmasana with my eyes closed, sitting quietly. I had no idea at that point it was yoga. It was something I used to do as a little child because I liked it. And when I got to university, in Freshers Week, there was a book sale in the Students' Union, and I chanced upon a book called Light on Yoga by B.K.S. Iyengar. Ever heard of him?
Yeah.
And it just blew my mind, because being a trained dancer, being a movement junkie, I just was obsessed by these extraordinary ways of moving the body. You know, it wasn't just on your feet, it was upside down and all kinds of crazy things. So I was obsessed, and I joined the yoga club at uni. So I started sort of doing a hatha yoga practice there, which was fun. And then when I was working in media in London, I ended up going to a random yoga class in Brixton in the 90s. And I guess it must have been an Ashtanga class, because it blew my mind. absolutely blew my mind. One class, it was the sequencing, it felt like dancing, and it gave me this incredible sense of euphoria, you know, that high you get from performing on stage.
Yeah.
When you're a dancer, I got that high from doing the practice, and I just couldn't believe, you know, what this thing was. So that was it. In that moment, my life changed.
Oh, amazing.
So it was completely random. And I think that's probably the same for so many people. I think that the Ashtanga practice finds you.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And then it gets you, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. And so where did it go from there? That was okay. Your sort of first experience. How did happened?
So my degree at university was dance anthropology, history and performance. So I needed to go to the source pretty early on to find out, you know, I needed to find out the guru. So as soon as I had learned enough, I started going to Mysore, which was at the end of the 90s, which was absolutely incredible. Because back then, as you know, there weren't that many students. So we had three teachers. We had Patabi Joyce, Sharat and Saraswati in the Shala teaching, you know, a few of us. So we just learned so much. And do you remember back then we could stay for months and months and months on end? We didn't have to leave.
Yeah, I know. So, that was incredible, right?
Yes. And everyone there was there without agenda. They were there to learn the practice from the guru, to be at the source, which was so rich and exciting. So it felt like being at university. So so that was amazing. And I just, you know, kept going back for the next 20 years for like six months or more at a time, which was amazing. So that was it, really. Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. So like in your early days, would you go back between the UK and India and teach a little bit in the UK and then go and study in India, or were you traveling? What was going on?
So I was working in media at the time. I had the most amazing boss. And rather than giving a promotion every year, I would say, yeah, but can I have a sabbatical, please? I need to go back to India to go and study for a bit. So that's how I managed to bag that. So yeah, so I was working in media in Soho for like, you know, half the year or a bit more than that, and then I would go to India to study in Mysore for the rest. So I managed to kind of wing that for many, 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 many years, until Patabi Joyce said, you know, it's time you started sharing the practice. Otherwise, I think I'd still be doing my fabulous job that I was doing then. But I had no intention of teaching Ashtanga. I only started doing it because Patabi Joyce said, you know, you share. Right. And obviously I love what I do. I can't imagine doing anything else now. But
it sounds like you had a pretty cushy situation happening.
Oh, it was great. I absolutely loved it. You know, working in London in the 90s and early noughties in media and music and film was, it was great.
Yeah. I think our mutual friend Nick Evans was in that same industry.
Exactly. Yeah, my dear Welsh friend Nick. Yes.
You had your own little posse going.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah, that's right. We did.
What was that first trip to Mysore like?
It was amazing. It was really amazing. I think it was it was December, so the first Christmas I had in India was weird, I have to admit.
Yeah. Wasn't it just weird, or had you been to like India before?
I've been to India before, but never at Christmas.
Okay.
Yeah, never at Christmas. So that was unusual, but you know, I think. Having an experience in a different country of something that's quite special to you is always going to be a bit strange. But you know, my first trip to Mysore was lovely. I mean, Patabi Joyce, I felt, was incredible. He was steady and consistent all the time, and he lived to teach the practice, to share it. And I loved that. And you know, Sharat and Saraswati too. I felt so honored and grateful to be there, and I loved all the people that went there. You know, everyone you met was a bit older, they'd lived a bit, they were interesting. Yeah, I absolutely loved those early days.
Yeah. Yeah. How old were you when you first went to Mysore?
Oh gosh. Now you're trying to, how old? I think I was about 28 or 29.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like it's true. I remember I turned 25 on my first trip in Mysore, and I was like super young compared to most of the people who were there.
Exactly. Like we were babies. I mean, I know I was considered to be incredibly young when I went.
Yeah.
Which was kind of weird. I'm not young, I'm 28.
Yeah.
but then you were kind of like meeting these people who've been practicing with Pattabhi Joyce, you know, for years, and which was so exciting to hear their stories and stuff. And, you know, it was great. And I think it was fun being young back then.
And I mean, you touch upon such an important thing. I feel like in the early days, it is probably the same now. But just like that sangha, that community connection, I learned so much from these senior teachers who were there and practicing, you know, as much as I was learning in the room, in my own like self-development and practice, I was learning like so much as of like theory and history and philosophy outside of the room from teachers who had more experience than I did.
Absolutely. And one of the things I've always felt about going to Mysore is that you learn about the stuff that you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you learn about patience.
Yeah, big time.
And you learn about shattering your ego. You know, you learn about really, really important parts of the yoga journey, which aren't asana, which I think is invaluable. That's one of the really profound things that I learned very early on, which was great.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because it happens in like a really subtle way, I find, you know, whereas like when you're in like back to that ballet training, it's happening in a pretty obvious way. You're like, wow, this person's really trying to like destroy my ego so that I like come back. So I bounce back. Right. Like it's so obvious. But in India, it's so subtle. Like you're just like irritated or you're just like, feeling all these different things coming up, and it's almost like this subtle arising of stuff, and then all of a sudden you see it and you're like, whoa.
And I think the other really fascinating thing is that education, the way I've experienced it in India, is very different from how I have experienced it in the West, both through ballet school and university. So I think the way the teachers work in India is incredibly different. And that certainly takes some getting used to.
Yeah, it's true. I remember people like come and they'd want like a program and a syllabus and like, and then it's just like, what? We just show up and practice and then the rest of the day is sort of mysterious.
Yes. So, but I think it's a great honor and it's a privilege to be in a different culture for a long period of time and to learn about that culture and to learn about different ways of doing things. And for me, that was an incredibly rich experience as well.
And you learn so much from even just the local people in the community there. I remember learning so much about Indian culture and like the struggle of like women in the Indian culture from the women who were living in the Indian culture. It's just so incredible to have that, like develop those relationships with the local people too.
Yes. And so very kind of them as well. Yeah, definitely.
Yes. And it also opens up your eyes, because I think the first, you know, my first trip there was just like, oh, it's so amazing. And it's like going back in time. And this is such an incredible place. And it had this real sort of magic sparkle on it, you know. But then after going so many times and getting more integrated into the community and developing local friends and connections and building those systems of trust, you know, you're exposed to other aspects of the culture that you normally wouldn't have been. And it is an honor, but you also realize like, oh, problems exist everywhere.
They certainly do. Yeah. And I've always felt that India is the polar opposite of here. You know, you cannot make sense of India. you know, you have to expect the unexpected. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you have to roll with it.
Yeah.
Nothing is as it seems.
Right. Yeah. But there's something like really kind of attractive, maybe, or alluring about that when you come from a society or a culture that's very logical and very, you know, like when you leave point A, you're for sure going to get to point B in this amount of time. Like you have Google Maps and, you know,
everything's
like really systematized. And then you step into this world where, like you say, there's this element of unexpectedness and mystery in you, and it's not dependable. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to leave here and arrive here at this time. It's sort of like, maybe that's going to happen. Oh,
there might be a bullet cart in front of you.
Right?
Yeah. But I think, you know, when you go to India as, you know, a tourist, or you're just going to Mysore to practice for 3 months a year or whatever, it's one thing and it's manageable. But it's quite something else when you actually live there full time and you're running a business or building a yoga retreat and you're having to deal with the day to day. Then it becomes a whole different thing, because, you know, we're used to everything happening, you know, when we snap our fingers over, you know, in our countries. Yeah. And I wrote on my website, actually, in my musings and fun section, a piece called The Way of the Drill, which was about building our yoga retreat in India, and mm-hmm. just a catalogue of hilarious after the fact events that you do not expect when you're building a yoga retreat, you know, and you can laugh about it once it's done, but going through it, it's just, you know, like one incident, I was having the shala built, and mm-hmm. I made it really, really clear to the mason that the shala floor has to be level.
Right. Yeah.
So went off for a few hours, came back, and then it's like, Ramesh, it's sloping. And he said, yes, madam, for drainage. I'm thinking, right. What drainage in my yoga shala? So it was like every day there's like a new thing. But you have to surrender and smile and laugh. And
oh, I know. Yeah. And it's so interesting. I have a similar situation where we had moved into this new apartment. And again, it was like just sort of in the time when people were like getting those little Nokia cell phones. Like before that, it was so difficult. You know, you'd have to call the landlord like at the payphone, and then he would say, oh, yes, madam, you know, the guy who's fixing the shower coming today. And then you just sit around all day waiting for the guy to show up. And maybe he shows up, maybe he doesn't.
And maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's got to go to temple. Yeah, I know.
Right? And then like the next day you go back to the payphone and call he didn't show up. Can he come today?
Yeah.
But at this time we had someone coming to fix like the water purifier or something, and they were installing a new thing. And so he comes in and he does the installation and then just leaves like a complete mess of like wall parts and like just like a complete disaster, like a construction site mess, like in the middle of the kitchen. And like, he's like, okay, bye. And we're like, are you cleaning this or no? But no, that's not his job. His job was only to do the water filter. Someone else's job is to come and clean it up.
Yeah, I know. So I think, you know, one of the amazing things is you learn how to surrender.
Yeah, totally, right? You have to.
Yeah.
Like not lose your mind, right? And it's kind of beautiful in that way. You're like, okay, this is how it's gonna go.
Yeah, I think you certainly learn.
I can be upset or I can surrender.
Yeah, and I think you learn quite quickly to see the funny side in things, don't you?
Yeah, you need a sense of humor for sure. Yeah. No, totally. Along those lines, is there any like memorable sort of travel experiences or teachers or workshops that you really feel like deepened your practice, like within India or outside of India?
I spent a month studying with Richard and Mary in Boulder in Colorado.
Oh, nice.
Which was, yeah. Oh my God, it was incredible. Those two, they are yoga, aren't they? They're so wise, knowledgeable, understated, funny, humble, and they know so much. So that was amazing for me. And I think that was one of the happiest months of my life ever, meeting those two. Obviously spending so many years learning from Pattabhi Joyce and Sharat when there weren't many people there in the Shala was incredible. Because we had heaps of attention and time. So we were privileged to learn so much from them. Before I was certified, I went on heaps of retreats and workshops all over the world with various teachers with whom I respected. I learned a lot about what makes a good teacher, actually, as well as about the asana practice and the eight limbs and philosophy and stuff. But the most interesting thing, I think, is that when I worked in media, I used to go to this class on Saturday mornings with someone who's now a mate called Robin Cato. And he really inspired me because he was really normal. He was totally himself in class. No airs and graces, spoke in his normal voice, in his normal vernacular. And I thought, oh my God, this is so amazing. You don't have to be, you know, all marshmallowy to be a yoga teacher. And it was so refreshing, you know, after encountering so many teachers who took themselves ridiculously seriously and basically pretended to be something that they're not. So that was just like a light bulb going on for me meeting him. And he's actually had a massive influence on the way I teach. So a mixed bag of influences, I would say.
I always, you know, we often, I think, in our little Ashtanga yoga bubble, people are always like, take one teacher and only study with that one teacher. And I know there's like some value to that for sure. But I think especially as a teacher who's like if you have an interest in teaching, it's like go take as many different teachers' classes as you can, because you learn so much about teaching and like what works, what doesn't work for you, what you like, what you don't like. It's so like it's the best education, I think.
And also in order to find out the right teacher for you.
100%. It's so important, I think, to like make that heart connection with who you're learning from.
Yes. But, you know, Pattabhi Joyce and Sharat will always be my teachers, always. Yeah. But it's fun meeting different people along the way because it's part of the journey, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's a difference in the way that like as Westerners and teachers, you know, from the West teach compared to the way that we were taught, I think, in Mysore, India. I mean, if there isn't a difference, you might maybe want to look at that a little bit.
You're a diplomat. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Well, that goes back to the point I was making earlier about that the ways of teaching are quite different, aren't they?
Totally. And also like touching upon like being your authentic self, right? Not trying to like just take a system and mimic it or mimic a teacher or, you know, but be yourself in that presentation.
And isn't that what the practice is all about? Being your true self.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The unlayering, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I love that. And speaking of unlayering, is there something like within your practice journey that you felt like really shifted, you know, was like a pivotal point for you that shifted either the way you were practicing or the way you were teaching, you know, because you've been teaching for so long and practicing for so long and like so many series, so many asana series. And I feel like the way that you practice in a sense to like push yourself through, and I'm going to use that word push yourself through series, like third series, fourth series, it's very intense. It's very hardcore. And like, you have to streamline so many things in your life to make that happen. You know, are you still practicing the same way? Are you teaching the same way? What sort of, how has it evolved for you?
Okay, so to answer the first bit of your question, has anything made you look at the way you were practicing? Yes, absolutely. So obviously after having two tendon grafts, one in each hand, I had to look to Mr. Iyengar for alignment.
Right. Yeah.
I think as serious Ashtanga Asana practitioners, we need to look to Pattabhi Joyce for the exquisite choreography and the elegance of the sequencing and the order and the vinyasa counts. It's so elegant and it's absolutely brilliant. And we have to look to Mr. Iyengar for the alignment. We have to marry those two things together. You cannot work through the later series if you haven't got excellent alignment. So I learned that lesson very early on. So after having my tendon grafts, it really made me focus on having perfect alignment, stretching out the wrists, as you said, the opposite way after arm balances, that kind of thing. It made me understand the importance of being balanced in gaining equal levels of strength and flexibility. And it made me learn how vital it is to learn the practice slowly and methodically, with perfect tristhana, correct vinyasa, learning the exact Sanskrit counts, inhaling when you're meant to be inhaling, exhaling when you're meant to be exhaling, not adding in extraneous movements that aren't there. You have to stick to the method, and then it works with the good alignment. So that was massive for me. So in my teaching, not only am I teaching, the correct or the specific sequencing with, correct tristhana and all of that kind of stuff, alignment has to be there as well. And I expect my students to have mastered one posture with, correct tristhana and alignment, breathing, all that kind of stuff before they learn the next, because there's no point bashing out a load of shapes and trying to get to the finish line if there's no yoga happening. It's just a futile exercise. That has really, really shaped the way I practice and teach. And I still do all of the asanas that I have learnt from my teachers, but I practice really slowly. You may not know this, I don't know if I ever told you this, but when I was in Mysore and I was learning the advanced B series, I was having to do all of advanced A and then about two thirds of advanced B before I was split.
Right. Yeah. Old school style.
Old school. But we learned old school.
We did.
So my practice was taking over 3 hours. And I'm going to say this, I can't believe I'm saying it publicly. I didn't have a ladies' day in over 3 years.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously that isn't good.
Right. It's not super healthy for.
but you know what? I think women need to speak more about this. I think we need to talk more about this stuff, because a male teacher isn't going to say to you, are you still having your ladies' days? Right. Are they? And of course, my teacher is Indian and it's not in his culture to kind of ask those, those kind of questions. And it was my own stupid fault for not saying, hey, did you know this is what's happening to me? But the interesting thing is, after I was split, they came back about two or three months later. So it's obviously connected to the intensity of the practice. I was doing way too much, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that is fascinating. So with the women in class, especially if they've got to go to work and do stuff, I'm very mindful about how long their practice takes.
I think that's so important.
And I encourage women with a very intense long practice to only practice 5 days a week. I think 6 days with an intense practice is too much. It certainly was for me.
Yeah.
The other thing, which I think is more to do with being a ballet dancer, is that I have osteoarthritis in a few of my joints, big toe joints, obviously from point work. In my neck from, years and years and years of doing Gandharva Dasana, putting my feet on the floor and my hands underneath my chin. So now I'm older and wiser, I have learned to practice incredibly slowly, and I try to make as much space as possible in the body, the mind, and the breath. Mm-hmm. And I think essentially that's what we're meant to be doing anyway, isn't it? Expanding the breath and keeping the mind and the body still. Yeah. And steady, and keeping the breath steady and strong, and keeping ourselves healthy. So, you know, when Patabi Joyce says, you know, slowly, slowly, all is coming, I think that's what it is. If you want to speed up the process of attaining the state of yoga, slow down.
I love that. I love it. So good. I'm just going to repeat it because it bears worth repeating. If you want to speed up the process of yoga, slow down.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so true. Yeah. I love that. It reminds me also of the Yoga Sutras, you know, when they say, that Ishvara Pranidhana Samadhi, or something about, you know, if you want Samadhi to come quickly, like Samadhi comes quickly for those who practice Ishvara Pranidhana.
Yeah.
And so it's like that idea of surrendering.
You've gotta have faith.
Yeah.
As George exactly. Michael said.
100%, right? Yeah. You gotta have faith. You gotta trust and surrender.
Yeah.
And then the mind will become balanced.
Yes, absolutely. And I really believe it, you know. I totally believe in the practice. I really, really do. And you just gotta trust and let go and don't rush, because it's all there if you allow it to happen when the time is right.
Yeah.
It has to be the right time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. And along those same lines, though, I mean, we see it so often, like sometimes the practice doesn't cultivate that sort of openness and awareness and presence for people. You know, sometimes it sort of feels like it's really like pushing and coming from an ego place, or it's, you know, what would be some advice you would give people to, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if it's coming from an ego place, if you realize it or not, but like, how do you move into that place of like more faith, more surrender, more allowing, you know? How do you slow down when it feels like, you know, a lot of people say, it feels like I should have started sooner. I've lost so much time, or I'm never going to get this right. Like there's a real sort of sense of urgency. How do you encourage people to slow down?
Well, you've got to start somewhere. And I think the access point for so many people with yoga is asana, isn't it? Because, you know, to be able to get to a state of yoga by just sitting and meditating is incredibly hard. So I think a lot of people aren't in their bodies. You know, we were dancers. Mm-hmm. We were lucky. We came to this practice having a connection to our bodies, and a lot of people don't. So I think that if you're not connected to your body, you're using sort of ego to try to force it to do things. So I think once you become connected to the mind and the body and the breath, then the practice starts to make sense. And once you understand the concept of Tristana, the perfect synchronization of the breath, the gaze point, and the movement, and develop that state of stillness in a posture, you do surrender. But until you get to that point of stillness, you're not going to be doing yoga. And I think it's only when you start to feel it, because it is an experiential practice, that you start to get it. And you know what, one of my students started when she was 65.
Yeah, amazing.
She is amazing, and she's 77 now.
Incredible. I love it.
And I adore this woman. She's a real character, and she's got so much one-pointed focus and determination, and she will keep practicing an asana until it reveals itself. And it just blows my mind, because there's no ego there. It's just determination and trust and joy.
Yeah. I love that you bring joy into the equation. Yeah, I feel it's so vital.
It has to be joyful. So it's about that surrender, and as soon as you surrender, the yoga can happen. But if you're there with brute force, then yeah, it's going to be a slightly longer journey.
Yeah, yeah, we don't know how long it'll take, right? It's so nice, so great to just glean your wisdom. Do you think people can get there on their own? Can they like do self-practice and have all these sort of revelations and uncover all these things within themselves, or is it helpful to have a teacher?
I think it is helpful to have a teacher. Well, because, you know, you can't teach yourself, can you, unless you're an expert?
I mean, I guess we're like living in such a strange place these days with like so many online resources. And like when you and I were learning the practice, we didn't really have that. You know, we had to, if you wanted to look at a yoga video, you had to like go buy a VHS and like put it in your machine or something, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So we had like some books, but it's kind of different learning from a book compared to like throwing on YouTube or like some kind of online membership or something where you can just sort of like watch and observe and never really cultivate that relationship with a teacher. And I think, I mean, for me, that's always the sort of sacred space, right? Is in that relationship that the yoga happens, rather than just like following along with a screen and someone who can't talk back to you.
Yeah. I mean, I think the teacher is vital, absolutely vital. Because you can't teach yourself something if you don't know about it, do you? And I think that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And it took me 16 years to start to begin to understand what yoga is. It wasn't until I had completed the Advanced B series that I suddenly realized that it's all about Tristana and good alignment. Right. It doesn't matter what posture you're doing. It doesn't matter what series you're doing. It's all about being in the state of yoga. So do you remember there was one conference when Pattabhi Joyce said to us, you can reach samadhi from just going up to Navasana. You can attain a higher state of conscious awareness, stillness of mind. You can attain a state of yoga by just doing the half primary series. And I never understood what that meant until I had finished Advanced B. And I just thought it was, you know, the system is so elegant. It's brilliant because for some people, obviously me, you have to kind of go through this really, really, really difficult practice to understand it's all about keeping your mind still and steady and focused. And there comes a point where you have equal levels of strength and flexibility, and you do have a very, very strong mind, and you're incredibly disciplined and you're incredibly focused. But until you get to that point, there's always this element of complacency. So the postures get harder and harder and harder, so you can never be complacent.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
And you do need a teacher, you know, on a practical level to teach you about all of this stuff, you know, the concepts of the method, how the method works. You need a teacher to share with you the precise Sanskrit vinyasa, the mantra. Then you need a teacher to teach you about alignments and all these things, to answer any questions that you have about the practice, because students have many, many questions. And I think, you know, it's a great privilege to kind of share with them and try and help them along the way. But I do feel, as a teacher, it's very important to be an equal. I hate the idea of hierarchy. And one of the first things that we were taught when I was doing my postgraduate in the education of adults is that students are VIPs, and you should be very honoured that they've made the effort to come into your class or your workshop or your seminar or whatever, and they should be deeply respected. And as a facilitator, all you're doing is imparting a bit of knowledge. So for me, that's how a teacher should be. And I think it's very important to be connected to the student so they feel that they are on the same level as you and they can ask questions and stuff, because in order to enrich the learning experience, I think the learner needs to be able to ask whatever they like and to not feel uncomfortable. And I think that is really, really important. So I do think the role of the teacher is absolutely vital, but the teacher has to be excellent, and the teacher has to know how to teach, and the teacher has to know about, you know, psychology and how to manage people's emotions and stuff, and to have a whole range of skills to impart this knowledge, because everyone is different and we all have different styles of learning. So you can't get that from YouTube.
Yeah, it's true.
Or a book. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that. I think, you know, it has me kind of even thinking about like the way that Patabi Joyce was taught, when you talked about like, you know, having some psychology around, like, I think sometimes teachers in, you know, in the modern day can try and like, they show up in different roles, right? Like sometimes they're maybe like a persecutor for the student, or trying to save the student, or, you know, we become kind of enmeshed and a little bit codependent with our students at times. And I think it's really, really important for teachers to, like you say, hold that space for themselves and hold that space for their students, so that they're really seeing their student, like, you know, as creative, resourceful, and whole. And like, they are like, on the same level as
absolutely.
Them, right?
Yeah, I think the role of the teacher is simply just to impart knowledge, and it is not to be, you know, any of the things that you just mentioned.
Yeah, or like, knows, right?
Yeah,
like, oh, let me tell you, you know, how live your life, kind of.
And I think that's dangerous territory. Because, you know, I don't think you should put teachers on a pedestal, because, you know, I consider myself to be incredibly ordinary and normal. And I try to be like, you know, this guy I told you about, Robin, who blew my mind because he was completely normal and the same as everybody else in class. And I thought, I want to be like that. And that's how I try to be. And I think that my students like that, because I'm normal in class and I don't get enmeshed in people's drama. I just simply won't go there. It's not my place. You can't be a shrink. You can't be a prefect. No. And I think it's a really an unhealthy environment if you start, you know, having dogma.
I can agree more. And it's interesting, because I'm curious, like, if this is a particularly feminine kind of approach, or like if this is coming from, you know, I mean, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, but just like the idea, I think women are a lot more like socially tuned in a sense than men at times. And I feel like, sorry to all the male listeners, but that, like, you know, our societal structures are always like putting men above like this group, and often it shows up like a group of women, right? Or like there's the one lead man, he's the captain, and then there's like a team of underlings, and like all these social structures are very I guess patriarchal in a sense, right? Where it's like, okay, there's one guy at the top, the CEO, and then there's all these underlings, right? And I feel like it's not feminine, maybe it's just like more modern, or maybe it's just like tearing down those structures of hierarchy, where it's more realizing that everybody has something to share, and that you can learn something from everyone, and that we're coming together to share in the ways where we're experts, or we excel, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in the Ashtanga world as well, I mean, there aren't that many female certified teachers, are there? And you know, when we were learning at the end of the 90s and early noughties and stuff, there weren't that many female teachers around. So
yeah, even less than now, for sure.
Yeah, right. it's quite interesting. I used to run an Ashtanga program in Soho before I moved to India. And it was interesting because my classes were 50-50 men and women, which I thought was fantastic. But that could have been because it was Soho. And there are lots of guys that worked in media and music around there. I don't know. But certainly now I see more women than men in classes. I would say there's probably 2/3 women, just 1/3 men now. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if it makes a difference being a woman. People prefer a female energy. I think on a practical level, learning from a woman who has been through a lot and who has done a lot and who can still laugh at life might be slightly inspiring.
Totally, 100%.
I think certainly I'm resilient and ordinary, and I think my students like the fact I'm resilient and ordinary, and they can laugh in class, and we do have a laugh. We work hard and play hard, and I know the guys like that as well. I certainly don't have any airs and graces, and I don't suffer fools, so anyone who tries to be above themselves, probably I'm not the right teacher for them. I think that, you know, there are certain things, like, for example, we mentioned arm balances. You know, learning arm balances from a woman who has learnt for herself how to execute a very complicated posture, and then they can share that to another woman, is going to be enriching, rather than from a guy with his big broad shoulders and his tiny little hips says, just do it like this. And then you think, yeah, but I can't.
Exactly.
So I think there might be an element of that. But I think ultimately, you know, teaching's a skill, it's a vocation, isn't it? And I think you have to be able to connect with your students and they with you, and be normal, and keep the practice light and joyful whilst communicating and teaching effectively and making your students feel comfortable. You know, I'm a believer of working hard and playing hard in a very balanced way, of course. And I think for me, I attract practitioners who for whom that resonates, whether they're men or women.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I love that we sort of, we emit a certain vibration or a certain energy and like draw people into our field, or the people who are like vibrating or resonating at that same energy, you know, enter into the sphere. I think I love that imagery.
But ultimately it's all about the practice, isn't it? You know, it's the practice that works, the practice that is going to go on after we've, you know, become worm food. So it's not about the personalities. It's really about the practice. And I feel it, you know, as a certified female teacher, it's an enormous honor and responsibility to pass on this method, you know, with correct tristana and precise Sanskrit vinyasa counts and sequencing and good physical alignment and technique, and to encourage practitioners to understand and honor the and experience how the method works. So, you know, we're here for a very short amount of time, and as certified female teachers, I think we've got a job to do. And we have to do it the best we can, don't we? And I think, you know, one thing I try to impart with my students, whether they're men or women, is that the skills that we all acquire on the mat can be applied to life. You have to become strong and elegant and graceful and kind and humble and resilient and peaceful and happy on the mat. And then, you know, that's just a life skill, isn't it? It's just a tool for making life a bit easier, ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. That's so good too. I'm continually and always, I mean, that's my favorite part of the yoga practice itself, is seeing how your life shows up in your practice, but then also how your practice transforms your life. And it's like magic, you know, there's nothing
it does.
You can
say and why. Suddenly your life has changed, and it's like, God, I didn't even realize that happened.
Yeah, totally. And the practice is always sort of a steady thing that, you know, even if it's not like doing your full practice, or even if it's just like sitting on your mat or doing Surya Namaskar, or connecting to your breath, or, you know, whatever it is that you can do, I always feel like it's such a good tool to have that discipline or that training of like, oh, I know how to calm my mind and connect to my breath. And even, you know, when terrible things happen in your life, to have those tools to be like, okay, like you say, that resiliency, that ability to bounce back. And I think the practice really helps to develop that awareness.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I don't think I would be able to maneuver through life if I didn't have my Ashtanga yoga practice. And I'm serious about that. I'm so serious about that. You know, it's an incredible discipline, which makes you feel very ordinary and connected and happy and present. And if I go a day without practicing, I feel the difference, you know, it's extraordinary. So, you know, it's amazing. It's a life tool, and I'm so grateful that to have it in my life.
That's beautiful. Yeah. So, you know, you lived in India for 20 years. Was it 20 years? But like a lot of it full time.
Yeah. Well, I started going there for long periods of time since the late 90s and kind of moved there full time about 12 years ago. Yeah.
Wow. And now since COVID, you've been back in the UK.
Yes.
Which is so different.
It is. Yeah.
What do you miss most about life in India?
Oh my God. How long have you got? All right. Oh, I miss the nature, the views, the light, the colors, the sunset, the intoxicating aroma of coffee flowers and jasmine, the incense, the food, the fresh produce, wildlife, cultural things such as classical music, dance, architecture, obviously not modern architecture, the old stuff, yoga, of course, styles. I miss road trips, seeing the country. I miss the palaces, the forts, the ancient temples, you know, all the history over there. Mm-hmm. South Indian breakfasts.
Me too.
And there are so many more things I miss. But yeah, I think of India every day, day. You know, there's a bit of it in my heart. Yeah. Always.
Yeah, 100%. It's just like that was just like an advertisement. Travel to India.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think, you know, students sometimes say, should I go? Should I go to Mysore? What do you tell your students when they ask you these questions?
I say absolutely. Of course you should experience it. I mean, you know, I and you, you know, so lucky to have spent studying at the Shala in Mysore for over 20 years every year, and that's a great privilege and honor, and I feel incredibly honored to have learned from Pitaba Joyce as well as Sharat. I know things are different now and there are way more students now, and the Shala is open for a much shorter amount of time each year, so it's trickier to get there. But I think you have to go to the source. It's really important to experience it. It's wonderful. You know, expect to learn things that you weren't expecting to learn about, but that's part of the ride, you know, it's all good.
Yeah. Sort of. I always feel like if you're really into Ashtanga yoga, if it's like your absolute, you know, passion in life, that it's like making a pilgrimage to the place where it originated, you know, from.
Yeah. You know, and I think you start to understand that the practice is experiential. It's a psychophysical practice that helps you become a better person physically, mentally, socially, emotionally. And there you really get the chance to feel that. Go. Definitely.
And make some side trips while you're there too.
oh god, of course. Yeah, I mean, there's so much to see and learn and do, isn't there?
Now when I dream of going back to India, it's like I want to go visit Bodhgaya, and I want to go back up to the Himalayas, and I have all these other places that I really want to go.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm hoping to go back to India next year, and that's one of the things I want to do. I just want to go to the places that I haven't been to. Like, I haven't been to Northeast India. I'm dying to check out some new stuff, to have some new experiences, you know.
It's such a beautiful, I don't know, mystical country, and yet it's so also like very ordinary, right? It's got that paradox happening all the time, and you see it and you feel it and you're like, whoa, this is
crazy. Think that paradox is that there are two Indias in one India.
I think
there's old traditional India and there's modern India in the same country, and it's all mixed up, and that's the paradox.
It's also kind of the beauty of it too, right?
Yes, it's an extraordinary country. It's an amazing country.
Well, we are not going to be able to find you in India right now, but if students wanted to come practice with you or reach out to you, where can they find you?
Oh, I'm teaching all over the world. I teach internationally. I'm doing retreats and workshops. All over. I do my own thing in London, in Leicester Square. I teach online. I teach Sanskrit County primary, intermediate and advanced A series classes on Saturday mornings. I teach privates online. But if people want to find out how to study with me, go to my website, ashvandaphilippa.com. It's all there.
Yes. The goodies.
But wonderful. I just want to say, you know, the Ashtanga yoga practice is the only thing in my life that makes any sense. And without it, I would not be able to, you know, I wouldn't have the skills that, you know, yoga gives you, you know, gives you sharp life skills, which is amazing.
And it gives you kind of like a safe harbor too, I think, in times of struggle. You know, you can just kind of go to it, and it can give you that like safe place, or that soft space for yourself.
Absolutely. And one thing I do want to say is that you don't have to do very much for it to work. You have to practice all eight limbs. I really believe that. You can't just do asana. You have to, you know, do the yamas and the niyamas, you know, the personal behavioral codes, the ethical codes, as well as the asana practice, the pranayama practice, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. You have to do all eight. It doesn't work if you just do asana. And I think that's important. And I think students have to understand that. And I think those, you know, we sometimes see people falling off the wagon. And I think usually it's because, you know, maybe one or two of the limbs is missing from the practice. So, you know, it has to be a life choice. It has to be a state of being and a state of mind, the way you live your life. But in terms of the asana practice, you don't have to do that much. You just have to do the standing postures, back bends, and finishing for it to work. But you have to be consistent.
That's beautiful. That's great. And great advice. And I couldn't agree more. That's like my favorite go-to practice, actually.
but it's amazing because your expectations are so low, but you get the desired effect. You finish and you feel the prana, you feel the joy, you feel amazing, and you're set up for the day. And I think that's really, really interesting, because so many new students think it's about collecting asanas. But, you know, once you've been practicing for 20, 30 years, you realize it's really not about that.
You're kind of happy to give those asanas back.
As possible to get the desired effect.
It's so true, right? You're like, oh, I don't need this one anymore.
Which is brilliant, you know, but with, you know, age comes wisdom, doesn't it? And I think you do have to kind of go through the journey of, you know, practicing for heaps and heaps and heaps of years before you get to that point and you realize that less is more.
Or, you know, I always feel like you're talking about your student, your 65-year-old student. I feel
she's
like
77 now.
Yes, 77, right? But like when you come to the practice later in life, you really approach it with a different intention and a different energy. And it's like a softer, kinder practice to yourself and to your body. I feel then sometimes like the younger students, like you're saying, it becomes about collecting asanas and transformation and like all of these big lofty kind of visionary goals, which is exciting and incredible and wonderful. And like, you know, you need to go on that journey, but like later in life, you're kind of using it as a means to heal and restore yourself, which is very different energy to the practice.
And that's when it becomes a tool for making life a bit easier. When you realize this is the thing that I need to do to restore homeostasis. This is the thing that I need to do to find balance. If you're agitated for whatever reason, in order to you know, to calm the waves of the mind, you need to do your asana practice. And it works. It so works.
Yeah, it's such a good thing to keep in mind for people, because I know it can, especially if you were on the journey in your young years and maybe you've had a break, maybe you've had a baby, or you've gone through different, you know, different life things, you know, tragedies, whatever, life circumstances, injuries, things, you know, to get back into the practice can be really difficult. And so, I mean, what would you say to people? How would you
coach someone to do that? Well, I've been through that, because, you know, I went through eight rounds of IVF when I was in India.
And that, I mean, that's really hard on your body and really difficult to practice, right?
And then got pregnant naturally and miscarried twins at the end of my first trimester. So that was incredibly hard, not only physically, but emotionally. But, you know, every cloud, I learned a lot from that experience, because, you know, being someone who was used to practicing all four series, which I was then, before I got pregnant, and then having to give it all up, because I tried a whole different ways of making the practice work for me. First of all, I did four series, then I did three, then I did two, then I did one, then I did nothing, which was the worst thing for me, because you know, I've been dancing since I was three, so for my body to stop was it's the worst thing ever. That was terrible. And then Hamish's wife Anna said to me, why don't you just practice as if you're pregnant? Just imagine you've got a big pillow in your t-shirt and practice like that. And that's when I got pregnant, when I was doing that. So hats off to Anna. So basically what that did was made me do a practice that was appropriate for me. So then obviously, you know, when you're pregnant, you don't practice and stuff. But the idea of, you know, not having done my fourth series, third series, intermediate and primary series normally for so many times, for so many months, I thought stupidly that I would lose it all. An idiot. You know, the muscle memory is so profound. It's so profound. Once the postures are in you, they're in you. They don't go anywhere. It might take a while to re-remember how to do them, but that's actually quite fun, you know. So my experience was, you know, eight rounds of IVF, getting pregnant, miscarrying twins, horrendous. So I can, you know, I probably spent a year with not doing my proper practice. And I came back to it slowly from, you know, from Samasthiti. I started off with Surya Namaskara A, and I brought it back posture by posture, just like a beginner. And you know what, Harmony? It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And you just relearn how to do the postures, but you learn how to do them perfectly. You pay so much attention to the exact Sanskrit counts and to learning it, relearning the postures, you know, without misalignment and not adding in stuff that's not there. And, you know, it didn't even take that long to get back to the end of fourth again.
It just
took a few months. So I always say to my students, just don't worry about it. Just bring it back slowly, posture by posture. What I do say is, do not add on a posture unless you've mastered the one before. So it's exactly the same as how you learn the practice. It's no different. You know, you keep adding on postures one at a time until they're perfect. Then you add on the next one. Just how you learn it. And it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I think it's just like trying to, it's a bit of a mindset thing, right? Like trying to not compare yourself to where you were, but like just be really present with where you are now. And just like you say, just go gradually. Like you can't force yourself or push yourself or get there any faster or get back to anywhere, right? It's just like we're going forward and just like have that beginner's mind, like you're saying, just learning who this body is now or where your mind is now and just doing like little by little every day, a little bit more. That's it.
So we're working within a framework, which is appropriate to us at a particular stage in our life. So the asanas may look slightly different every day. You know, you watch two or three practitioners doing the same posture, it's not going to look the same on each practitioner, is it? And it's the same in our practice at different life stages. And that's okay. It's really okay. As you know, as long as we've got perfect synchronization of breath, drishti, and movement, the Sanskrit vinyasa counts are there, the great alignment is there. That's all that matters. A bit of joy.
Yeah. Or a lot of joy.
Yeah, a lot of joy, a whole lot of love. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always found that from you. I've always appreciated those qualities that you have an infectious laugh. You always bring so much light and energy to the room and the conversation, and you're just yourself. And I've always really appreciated that from you. It always.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, for me, that's the practice. It's about being your best self, being your true self, and not pretending to be something that you're not.
Yeah, 100%. I love it. It's so true. Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming on as our guest today. It was such a pleasure to connect with you again, reconnect with you, and have all of your wisdom dispersed, hopefully, to thousands of listeners everywhere around the world.
It's been so lovely chatting to you, Harmony, and I hope I get to see you again soon. It's been too long.
I know. I hope so too.
Since we had South Indian breakfast together in Gokulam. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, if I'm ever in your neck of the woods, I'm going to look you up.
You know what? There's an amazing South Indian restaurant in Leicester Square. So if you're ever in London, I will take you there.
And we all can
have closer. Yeah.
That'd be wonderful. For sure.
Excellent.
Maybe I'll even make it out of bed to come to your class in time.
Oh, well, the good news with me is that I teach from silly o'clock until midday.
Oh, that's good. That's perfect. Silly o'clock. I love it.
Yeah. So something for everyone, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. My mid morning time will be perfect then.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We'll chat with you soon.
Lovely. Thank you, Harmony, and see you soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Finding Harmony with me, your host, Harmony Slater. You can find out more information on my website, harmonyslater.com, and I look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Standing in eternity's shadow, watching the breaking waves, there's a heart.